Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Performing Arts, a podcast from the New Books Network. My name is Andy Boyd. Today in the program, I'm talking with Paula Hernandez about her book, Staging Lives in Latin American Theater, Bodies, Objects, Archives. Paula, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me here, Andy. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
Could we just start out with a very general question of, could you tell us a bit about your background and how you first became interested in theater?
Sure. Well, I'm originally from Buenos Aires, Argentina, and I came to the U.S. a few years ago to study. I did my undergrad in Colorado, Colorado State University in Fort Collins, and then I decided to go into grad school. And at the time, my then fiance told me about the University of Kansas that had the best program in theater. For Latin America, and I had no idea. So we went to the University of Kansas, and I had the pleasure of studying under George Woodyard, who was one of the founders of the field of studies in academia of Latin American theater in the U.S.
I think that's also one of the oldest programs in the country, too, isn't it?
It is. It is the oldest and the first, really.
There,
now we have a few other places. And now I'm at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, where I teach and research Latin American theater and performance and visual arts and Latinx as well. So,
great. When you were growing up in Buenos Aires, did you see a lot of theater like as a kid?
Yeah, I did, but not the high quality theater that it has. Unfortunately, I saw a lot of what the schools would get, and It wasn't the best theater at the time. But we did read a lot of theater. I had wonderful literature teachers who we would read, a lot of theater that was, from Florencio Sanchez, for instance, who was one of the pioneers in the theater of early 20th century. So it started from there, or the Grotesco Criollo, which we did a lot of reading theater. I did not get to see theater until my 20s, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
One of the things that's always kind of bothering me about American theater, United States theater, is how sort of enthralled to neoliberalism it is. And Latin American theater definitely seems to be less so. So how have Latin American theater artists pushed back against, what's been called the Washington consensus?
That's such a good point. I focus on Buenos Aires right now just from my upbringing. But if you ever go to, for instance, Buenos Aires, you're going to go and see on a Friday or Saturday between 400 to 500 different performances, theater in and around the city. And what that is you're going to see commercial theater, but also independent theater that sometimes happen at garages, someone's garage, and they're all really high quality theaters. And people have a tendency to, have this tradition of theater. You can go to one of these theaters in a garage and you're sitting next to someone who is a well-known actor who's wants to see good theater. So it's not the same as here. You do not have to have these huge rooms and spaces with lighting and with expensive lighting. They've always found a way to, you know, make theater with what we have. You know, it's a tradition also from the 50s and 60s and 70s when theater, teatro de grupo or collective theater kind of had that political side to it, right? Give me a stage, whatever stage, and I will give you theater. Mm-hmm. And it's still very much alive today in all of Latin America, that you can see amazing plays that do not have to have this kind of neoliberal stance or high price tickets or, you know, these kind of traditional structures where they happen.
Yeah. A lot of the theater you write about in this book is broadly documentary theater. And documentary theater is really interesting to me because I feel like a lot of documentary theater doesn't really answer the question of why is it theater? You know, I'm thinking about something like the Laramie Project. You know, why didn't they just take a film crew to Laramie and interview people? I mean, I sometimes feel like I don't understand why the live medium is necessary when you're doing a documentary piece. Mm-hmm. But that's a question that the artists in your book grapple with in a pretty central way. Could you talk a bit about how they kind of answer that question, that like, why does this have to be on stage question?
Well, I know that these artists never compare themselves to film, although one of the artists I treat, Laura Arias, did a play and then a film about the play, which is a very interesting dialogue that she creates between stage and the film, right? But for the most part, they do this type of theater encounter because it is an encounter of people to motivate people to see a story, sometimes retold by an actor witness, by someone who participated or has something to do with the story, or sometimes by people who are not trained in the theater. They're called interpreters or occasional actors who bring their rawness, right? That raw body that is not trained as a document to the stage. So it creates tension. It creates the possibility of failure right in front of your eyes. And having that live aspect of documentary theater in front of you has actually made a huge impact on many different forms of the visual arts and I'm focusing right in Latin America. So for instance, you have a group of, in Lola Arias, Argentine Lola Arias, playwright and director, she started working with a group of actors who had some sort of connection to the last dictatorship in Argentina. They were second generation, meaning they were the children of parents, some of whom had been disappeared, some of whom, were still alive and survived it, or some of whom had nothing to do with the military, you know, they had nothing to do with the disappearances. So what happens there is she creates a story in front of our eyes that kind of makes us laugh and question the archive while also telling a story from the raw emotions of people in front of you. And I think that's what this documentary theater does so well, that it cannot be captured really in film, is that raw emotion and affect that you see in front of you, a few feet away from you. You sense those pulses, you sense that tension, you know, you can actually get that energy. So I think it's not so much that comparison with film, it's more how does theater make a stand and it actually how it created a huge energy and kind of recycling of this, because as I say in my book, Vivi Tejas, director and curator in Buenos Aires, was kind of the beginner of what she calls biodrama, right? The biodrama aspect of how to deal with theater that is not so-called the fictional setting of theater, that everything can be theatrical if we have a different way of looking at it. And I think that's how it kind of caught fire from her and other artists who could see how potential or the power of this type of theatricality that they work with a real and the fiction at the same time.
Do you think part of the reason why this type of work has resonated so deeply with audiences, especially in Chile and Argentina, is that it provides a context to think about kind of political issues that are usually not aired in public, that are kind of swept under the rug? I'm thinking specifically of the aftermath of the right-wing dictatorships in those countries, which are now, you know, I mean, Pinochet left power like 30 years ago at this point, and it still seems like that country has not had the kind of national reckoning that maybe would be necessary to fully move on from something like that. Is that part of what documentary theater provides in the Southern Cone?
Yes, exactly that. That it's a different window that, you know, the theater, let's backtrack here. The tradition of theater in Latin America, especially in Argentina and Chile, since you've mentioned them right now, is so part of our culture, is so ingrained. You grew up going to the theater, even like I said at the beginning, even bad theater that I had to watch in school, but you still grew up reading theater and knowing about theater. It is quite different from the US, where theaters always seems to be separate, right? So by the fact that it's part of our culture and you can go anywhere for a very affordable price, then theater does become another outlet of you know, opposition to what is going on. And the specific case of what I'm dealing in the book is the newer documentary theater. It brings up points of historical data, historical archives, and it kind of questions it in front of our own eyes. And instead of doing it in an official way, what these artists are doing, some of them, like I said before, they're actually asking second generation children, well, children that are in their 40s now, right? But asking them to tell their stories and see how they lived the stories of their parents, some of whom are disappeared, and how does the archive of photography, of videos, of letters kind of confront the idea of what the archive was told to them and to us. And so it's done with humor, it's done with kind of irony, and but at the same time, it is a very poignant point about, you know, the dictatorship in that case and how it evolved in our lives and how we react to that 30, 40 years later. Chile, the same way, we have one of the places, even by Lola Arias, who did, she did a similar play. It's called Mi Vida Después, My Life After, in Argentina. And then she did El Año en que Nací, which is the year I was born, in Chile. Kind of the same structure, right? Having children questioning what they heard for so many years about the archive, both family archives, national archives, official archives, and actually having the stage to question that and to relate to that in a very different manner.
I feel like part of maybe what, I mean, I hate to go back to this theater film dichotomy, but I feel like part of what you're doing when you do a documentary play is kind of introducing the question of authenticity kind of in the form of it, because oftentimes, you know, it's a recreation of events, or it's a retelling of events rather than, you know, footage from the event. And that made me think about the ways that some of these artists kind of blur the line between documentary and fiction. For example, I just read Guillermo Calderón's play Kiss, which includes a sort of play within a play that is presented as a play by a playwright in Syria, but is actually, you know, it's actually a play written by Guillermo Calderón. So yeah. What are the sort of artistic and political stakes of that practice, of that blurring of the line between the nonfiction and fiction?
Well, I think that's one of the major proposals of this type of theater, is that theater allows for this blurring to happen in the present time, right? In live action. It's not edited. And if it's edited, it's edited ahead of time, but it's not edited at the present time. So it's one of those ways to make us laugh about the constructions that we all have in our heads about what is fiction and what is not. And kind of playing with us. A lot of the times, intertextual analysis, like you just said, you know, Guillermo Calderón is very well known for creating those stories within a story, right? And then you don't know who is actually the author or what the story is actually about, because you don't, you know, the original, you never kind of understand it. Or when you understand it, it's so diluted that you laugh about the story itself. So I think the theater brings that blurring a lot more to life than the film. The film, I mean, it's there. And like I said, Lola Arias did create a film that is called The Theater of War, El Teatro de Guerra, which is after what she did with the play Campo Minado, Minefield, which is about the Falkland Islands between Argentina and Great Britain in 1982. And so she does a film, but the film is about the play. It's about the rehearsals of the play. It's about how the play was constructed. So it's kind of that, what you were explaining with Calderón, right? That intersexuality that kind of plays humorously with how these genres are blurring themselves. But for the most part, it's the theater that comes to life, and it's the theater, the presence that the bodies that we have in front of us that have that sense of authenticity, if I may use that word, right? That we have the body, we have the objects right in front of us, we have those archives building in front of us and deconstructing in front of us at the same time.
Now that we've got a bit of the context down, I'd like to ask a kind of theoretical question. What would you say is the difference between what we ordinarily call realism in theater and what you call in this book theater of the real?
Well, yeah, I mean, realism, you know, it's kind of that sense of naturalism that, you know, at least in the Spanish side of the theater and Latin American theater, it's more the 19th century, 20th century, beginning of 20th century, where you have this costumbrista, this kind of way of doing things that kind of related a real story or the life, right? The customs and traditions of that culture. What we see as theater of the real, and as in the book, I use that term from Carol Martin's work, is quite different. It's creating something through the objects, through the bodies, through the archives that have some sort of authenticity, that have some archival weight on them, that when they're brought into the stage, then they themselves have a story to tell, right? And so that's the real within this theater. How sometimes, you just have, for instance, in Vivi Teja's work, you have regular people, you have philosophy professors, you have her own mother and her own aunt on stage. And you have these bodies that populate the stage. And what's important about that reel is that they are themselves and they're telling you their life through showing you their objects. And at the same time, there is a story there because the theatricality that Vivi Tejas uses, which she uses this poetic measurement that she calls the umf, the umbral mínimo de ficción, which could be the minimal threshold of fiction, something like that, where she talks about how much or how little fiction can be in everybody's life. So that's where the real begins to work. And it's not realism. It's almost, I would say, almost the opposite of that. It's
right.
Not curated as such. It's curated as where are the, you know, what's the possibility of failure? And when you have someone who's your mother, you know, your aunt, who have never acted in their life, and they're sharing their photographs and they're sharing their dresses, and, you know, and what is this real there? Why is it important? How does the theater become the real and the real become theater? That blurring of those two kind of opposing sides is so interesting in this type of theater that I work in documentary forms.
Yeah, I'd love to talk more about that idea of failure. I mean, Vivi Tejas has had a theater company called Teatro Malo, literally bad theater. I mean, you talked about seeing bad theater when you were a kid in Argentina. I don't think that's what you were talking about.
No.
So what is the role of failure in her work and the possibility of failure? Why is that important to her?
Well, because she did it. She's known as the queen of the underworld in the sense of the under theater, right? Where she created this group in the 1980s. She called it Teatro Malo because it was kind of bad theater. And she started exploring ideas of how to work with, things that were not curated or edited or crafted. And so, for instance, she found this old play that had grammatical mistakes and had typos and was horrible. And she said, let's do this with her group, Las Bay Biscuits, right? And it was an irony. It was parody. It was parody of what theater is supposed to be. And she found in that failure something. She found the idea of what if theater can actually be born from failure, right? And how can this be a fruitful terrain to work? And then from there, she, one of the projects that Vivi Tejas did that was to me foundational was called Proyecto Museos, which is a museum project where she asked different artists at the time to go and find theater in the museums. And she sent them to very weird, strange museums in Buenos Aires, like the Museum of the Eye, the Museum of a Pharmacist. and so she sent them to all of these museums to find the theatrical in it. And that idea also of failing, right? Like, how can you recreate a museum in the theater and vice versa? And the same idea goes when she works with people who are not trained in the theater. When she created the Biodrama project, she invited Stefan Kaegi from Rimini Protocol, who is a German-Swiss group. The premise was you have to work about something about people who are alive in Argentina. And Stefan Kaegi said, okay. And he gets to Buenos Aires and he finds the zoo was really close by to the theater at the time. And he says, I'm going to stage a play about pets and pet owners. And, and he ended up with 14 animals on stage. That idea of failing, right? How do you control 14 animals on stage and their pet owners who have no idea about the theater? How do you work with that and what comes out of that failure or that possibility of failure? And that has been very fruitful and productive for Vivi Tejas and many other artists who worked under that same program or method, right?
Mm-hmm. Lola Aria seems like kind of a kindred spirit to Vivi Tejas. Could you talk a bit about how her work kind of questions national history in her context?
Yeah, Lola Arias, so the play Mi Vida Después, My Life After, which premiered in 2009, was the last play that was supposed to happen in the macro project Biodrama, right? Biodrama started in 2002 and it had about 14 or 15 different plays by different directors. Stefan Kaegi was one of them, but the majority of the directors were Argentine. Lola Arias was the last one, and by the time it premiered, Vivi Tejas had left the project, and so when it premiered, that play was not premiered under Biodrama. However, the structure is of a Biodrama play, and that what Lola Arias did is she basically took those instruments, those tools of that Biodrama structure, right, working with she actually worked with actors in this case, but working with a real story and how does that real story, relate to the theater. And Lola Arias took it to a totally different exponential, right? She worked with that. And then after that, she really did a lot of work with other artists. Actually, Stefan Kaegi was her partner at the time. They did different plays in Sao Paulo and then in Switzerland and then also in Chile. Later on, she did it on her own, El Año en que Nací. So she Lola Arias created a transnational kind of approach to theater, where that idea of the real can be seen in different manifestations. One of the biggest, I would say, is when she did Ciudades Paralelas, Parallel Cities, with Stefan Kaegi, that took place in different cities around the world, in Germany and Switzerland and Argentina and other places, where they invited other artists to work on the reel of some sort of event. So some artists worked on reel events at the library, some other ones at the court, some other ones like Lola Arias did a play about the hotel and the maids that clean the hotels behind us, and the invisibility of this work and the migrancy of this work. So I think, you know, it's... from where it came, from that idea, nascent idea of the biodrama, Lola Arias has taken that to a totally different level right now. And she keeps on working and creating that type of work with, for example, migrants. Right now she worked last year or 2 years ago with migrants into Germany. She's living in Berlin, Germany right now. And so it's and the play was called Futureland, and she worked with migrant children who were arriving in Germany, and how she basically gave them a way to tell their stories in a very theatrical way, but also exploring the real of their stories, right, in a very theatrical way.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
And she also did a extended project, a multi-part project on the Malvinas/Falklands war. I'm not sure what terminology to use in this case, which was a, you know, obviously a conflict where two opposing right-wing governments stirred up nationalist fervor to distract from their own regime's domestic failures. So really no good guys in this conflict, at least from my point of view. And yet Arias places the stories of combatants in that war together on the same stage.
Yeah.
What does that juxtaposition reveal?
I think that's one of the most fascinating plays that I've seen in many years. And it's fascinating because of the work that Lola Arias did curating it. First of all, it's kind of a trilogy, right? Because she started with a video, which she called Veterans. And it's a video installation where she worked with five different veterans from Argentina. And they're actually, it's a film because they're looking at the camera and they're reenacting their stories, right? So they tell their stories while they're reenacting them. And then after that, she created the play Campo Minado Minefield. And then after that, she created the Theater of War, which is the film that we were talking about before. I think what was so key about Campo Minado Minefield is that, yes, it's the dilemma of the Malvinas Falklands War in 1982. But she has six veterans, three from Argentina and three from Great Britain. One of those from Great Britain is from Nepal, right? So it was a Nepali Gurkha fighter, Gurkha soldier. So this is so interesting because when she tried to actually get funding to do the play, to premiere the play in Buenos Aires, she couldn't find it. And she couldn't because theaters were kind of saying, wait, what? We're going to listen to the Brits to tell their stories? What? And Malvinas is so alive in Argentina that, you know, she had to say, this is not about who was right or who was wrong. This is about the stories. This is about the past. But it wasn't until it was premiered in England and it was so successful that she was able to finally find support in Argentina to get the play, premiered there. And actually it was premiered at a different theatrical, the university had to find a different place to premiere because the theaters were still doubtful. So what was key here is that she did create one of the first times that you see real veterans with no acting training telling their stories, but also reenacting the stories of each other, working as a team, playing. They have a band. They play as a music band live during the play. But there's also a lot of emotion and a lot of work through them and friendship. You can see friendship. You can see emotions very raw during the play. So I think it's going back to your first question about theater and film, even though she created a film about this, it is that play that really gets you. I mean, it's just one of those moments that you see, even if you were not part of it, even if you're not Argentine or British, even if you don't understand what that war was about, to the fact that you see those veterans and sometimes they confront each other and sometimes they show you what that meant to them, that story meant to them, it is just heartbreaking. And at the same time, it's funny, it's cruel sometimes, it's raw, but it's just a wonderful play.
Another group you write about is Teatro Linea de Sombra, which is a group from Mexico. And you write that this group combines a commitment to very rigorous research, academic research, anthropological research, and yet also a commitment to aesthetic beauty. Why is that important for this group to balance those two impulses, and how do they achieve that balance?
Yeah, Teatro Linea Sombra is, to me, is one of those magnificent groups. You know, we're talking about the theater, the collective group in Latin America is still very much alive. There's a lot of theater groups like Teatro Linea Sombra who are doing amazing work. But Teatro Linea Sombra, I think they're quite distinct from other groups because they are a group that work with whatever matter or topic they are researching. So the difference is that they're not just doing a play, for example, Amarillo, which is their most successful play from 2009. It's a play about, you know, telling the journey, the story of a person who's crossing the US-Mexico border, right? And just the horrible travel and what happens during that time. But it's not, they don't just do a play about that. What they do is they actually work with shelters. They work with the migrants. They give them the tools they need to be educated about what they're going to be doing. They, if they work with the shelters, they ask the shelters, what do you need? What can we help with? And they build a chapel. They built an, they helped build an oven to bake bread. They called a baker to teach them how to bake that bread in that oven. So I think it's one of those combinations of activism. They don't want to be seen as activists, but they kind of are. And the work that they do as theater practitioners, which if you ever get to see one of their plays, the editing that goes into it, the beauty that shows through the images that they create, the digital versions of the screen that they use, and how photography becomes almost a painting. And all of a sudden you do know that you're seeing something about death and tragedy, but at the same time, they create beauty within this somber topic. So it's one of those groups that not only do they do residencies, long residencies and workshops and labs to research what they're doing, but they're actually, they walk the walk. They work with las patronas. Las patronas are these women who, throw food at the migrants who travel on top of La Bestia, right? The train. Mm-hmm. And they worked with them. They took the play Amarillo to Las Patronas in 2013 or 2014, to make, you know, to really have an emphasis on why this play and how they can actually make a political and social commentary on what's going on. And that's just one example. They do other topics and other plays, right? But I think that's one of the few groups that I can see with such a political and social commitment with such a high regard for theater aesthetics. It's not a propagandistic theater. It's not a pamphletarian theater. It's a beautiful theater, but it's also part of a social activism that they do.
Yeah. You mostly write about either ensemble generated work or kind of director driven work in this book, but you also devote a chapter to the playwright Guillermo Calderón. Why did you want to place his work next to the theater groups that you write about?
Well, Guillermo Calderón is the most renowned theater playwright director right now in Chile. And he calls himself one of the most politically outspoken playwrights in Chile, which he is. And he has always used documentary techniques, sometimes not to create documentary plays. There's a difference, right? Mm-hmm. You can use a technique, but not really be documentary. So what I like about Calderón, and I think why it's so important to add it into a book about documentary theater in Latin America, is that he has worked with materials like documentary materials about, for example, Villa Grimaldi, which was one of the biggest torture centers in Santiago de Chile, to create a play that is not documentary in itself, but it does base itself in a real story. Mm-hmm. So I think, to me, that is what his theater is so impactful. sorry. At the same time, you see that his work has kind of evolved, and similar to how Lola Arias has this trilogy, how, you know, her plays kind of evolved, he has the same thing. He used Jorge Mateluna as one of the consultants to create the play School. And Jorge Mateluna had been a member of, the far left group during the dictatorship. He had been imprisoned for a few years, and they used him as, you know, as a consultant to see if the play was telling the story right. The story is the play is about how the schools created cells to react against Pinochet, right? And what they were doing, how they built bombs, for instance, and how, why do they have to wear those hoods to be, you know, invisible and to not and be anonymous, right? How, and so they called him to give them some sort of guidance. Well, what happened is then Mateluna was convicted of stealing money from a bank, which he claims to be innocent, and all the data and information tell us that he's innocent. So they created another play, and that is the most documentary play of almost the whole book, which is called Mateluna. And it's a play about a tribunal kind of play about why is this guy being held in prison when all the data shows that he was not, that he was innocent, right? That he was not part of that robbery. And I think for me to write a book about Latin American theater of the 21st century and not add Calderón would have been a big gap, because I think even though he works differently than other ones, you know, he is still very much a person that he's also worked in theater groups. He used to have different theater groups himself. But yeah, he is a lot more, I would say, maybe more like Lola Arias, right? That they're kind of their own in the sense of how they create their work.
Why is it so important for Calderón in so many of his plays to resist the idea that Chile should simply move on from the dictatorship? Why is it important to keep that memory alive?
Well, because, you know, up until December 2019, I believe, that, you know, Chile still had, the constitution still had, legislation created by Pinochet. I mean, still to this day, they're still trying to change a few things. They just changed, and I believe it was October or November of 2020 that finally they changed part of the legislation from Pinochet about education. But if, you know, Pinochet did a lot more damage in the sense of creating legislation and creating this neoliberal state in Chile than in almost any other country in Latin America. And so for people like Calderón, it's not something that they can just forget and, you know, and keep on going. It's something that is present. It's not something from the past. If you're still living with a constitution that basically does and says what the changes that Pinochet put in place, and I believe in 1981, then, you know, what good do you have, if you don't confront those issues? And so, for example, when he created the play Villa from Villa Grimaldi, Villa Grimaldi had not been established as an official torture site. And I believe, and I did not look my numbers up before this interview, but it was early 21st century. So, you know, so here we are, how many years after, right, 1990s when it ended, we're still seeing a lot of remnants of that dictatorship that they're hidden either in legislation or in ways of doing and living the economy.
Yeah, I saw a protest sign from Chile that said neoliberalism began in Chile and it will end in Chile. let's hope, right?
Let's hope, but I doubt it. But yes, I don't know if it began in Chile, but Chile was one of the ones that really did so much damage to that, and they're kind of a central point of departure and for neoliberal policies. Yes, I would say yes.
Well, Paula Hernandez, it's been so great to talk to you about your book, Staging Lives in Latin American Theater. Thanks so much for coming on New Books in Performing Arts.
Well, thank you, and thank you for interviewing this. And I hope people read the book and enjoy it.